This week on the show, does Facebook's future lie in a web browser, the lawless world of copyright, and the land of WTF? ASCAP wants money from your 30 seconds of listening. All this on This Week in Media, episode 151. Boys and girls, we are back with another edition of your fair show. Fair, like happy, positive, you know, like My Fair Lady. Sorry, I love musicals. I don't know where that came from. Okay, I'm Daisy of the New Media Minute and TWIM and iMedia and BTV. And I've been off for a couple of weeks doing various things. I was at an iMedia conference last week, a brand summit in San Diego. So now I'm back at the helm. And last week you had Alex and Tim
the
doing
two of
the
us.
Show. Just the two of you.
Holding down the fort.
Just the two of you.
It was very.
How was it?
You know, It was nice. It was good.
I was sweating bullets, Daisy. I was sweating bullets. We missed you.
And Tim, how are you doing? How is your new video? I know you have a new video about how to do webinars, how to make money with webinars for French Made TV. How's that doing?
It's delicious. It's fun. It's a good time for everyone.
And so who's your advertiser with that?
Dim Dim. Webinar service.
All right. Very cool. Good. Glad to hear you're keeping yourself busy as we expect. And a first time guest, though I know everybody has heard of her and is a fan of her work because she's famous. Felicia Day. How are you?
I'm good.
Thank you so much for joining us. Tim Street gets the credit. He corralled Felicia. He booked her. He made sure she could come on the show. We're all delighted. I think I can speak for the audience when I say they are delighted to hear from you as well. Before we get into news topics, Felicia, update us on what you're doing. Your show, Dr. Horrible, had an Emmy nomination. What are some of the new projects that you're working on? Last time you and I emailed was probably for TV Week in the spring. So what are you up to these days?
I'm still working on The Guild. It's never ending. In a good way.
You're in the third season now, right?
Yeah, we're actually episode 4 comes out tomorrow on Xbox and MSN and Zune, and we're just editing episode 9. Like, I was just doing notes actually before I got in here. So it's pretty cool. We keep going, which is awesome. They keep picking us up, which is great. It keeps me looking.
What is the average viewership for an episode of The Guild?
You know, it varies. I think we have we had 25 million views across all platforms. I think we have 6 or 7 million unique downloads on Xbox, which is really good. I mean, they're very happy with our performance because, you know, you can get a lot of video on Xbox, but people aren't aware of it. So not only are we bringing awareness to the fact that you could stream HD and download and all this stuff, but, we're an independent show and it's pretty cool to be on. Yeah, up there with all the fancier shows.
And of course, you're such an inspiration to a lot of video creators. And one thing that I want to get into a little bit later on the show is just kind of, you know, maybe some of your advice, production tips, that sort of thing. We try to do that when we have other video creators on the show. But let's get into a little bit of news first. Now, all the speculation last week was originally surrounding whether Google was going to be buying Brightcove, which turned out to not happen. But instead, Google launched an ad marketplace. This was first reported in the New York Times on Friday. And basically, this is through DoubleClick, which Google has owned for some time now. And what this is essentially an ad exchange, which is a place where display ads can be bought and sold on an auction basis, very much like what Google, sorry, I keep wanting to say YouTube, even though I know they're
the same
company.
Yeah,
it's all the same. Just to have YouTube on my mind so much. So basically where advertisers and publishers can buy and sell ad space, mimicking the text ad model that Google pioneered and of course has ridden to $6 billion war chest yearly success and so on and so forth. There are some skeptics about this because as much as Google is a smashing success, it's a smashing success primarily in one area. I want to start with Alex and Tim because I know you guys know this story well. What are your thoughts on the DoubleClick ad exchange?
Well, you know, I think that it's going to be a pretty big deal. I think that while Google has only been, you know, massively successful in, you know, one area, I think that that this is something that if it's not that far from what they already do well. You know, and that's the thing is that there's a 60% overlap over what they're already doing really, really well. And it's just adding
60%. What do you, what,
well, what I mean is that there's to? Just that they already do ads. They already place okay. ads all over the place. They have a system that's successful that's already related to that. And now being able to just open that up to display ads, I think is a pretty big deal. I think they're going to be able to do, I think, you know, it'll be interesting to see. I think they could really become dominant in this field.
Okay, but what about, and Tim, I'll put this to you. I mean, we've seen Google play in the radio business with Remnant. We've seen Google play in the print business. Both of those efforts have been shuttered. Of course, there's Google TV ads, which I don't think has been a massive success by any stroke of the imagination, but is still chugging along. They're still adding new distribution partners to that, new networks to that, and certainly pushing forward with that. So I think so far I would categorize Google TV ads as a niche success. Given that, Tim, what do you think is the possibility with display ads and DoubleClick?
Well, this looks like it's some type of redo of what Yahoo has done with Direct Media Exchange with Right Media that they bought a few years back. I'd like to see it work. I'd like to see it be a big success, but I'm worried that it's going to commoditize things. And, for online video producers or publishers, as we're called in this world, it's going to commoditize things and us, you know, we're going to make less money.
Wait, in what way? Give a specific example. How would it commoditize an online video producer, for instance?
Well, it doesn't make your inventory special. It makes it Remnant. So it's great that there's a marketplace and there's a place that you can put your stuff, but what these different networks, these ad networks tend to do is they tend to commoditize and bring the price down, and that's great for the advertiser. That's good for you if you want to advertise your show, but if you want to make money off of your advertising inventory, it doesn't make your inventory special. It kind of undercuts any special pricing that you have. So you really have to be careful how you approach these networks, because they're tempting to get into. It's easy. Well, I say it's easy. DoubleClick is one of those things where they've always had a threshold of like $5,000 to get to play with DoubleClick. I think that's changing. I haven't checked it out lately, but you a lot of times you had to go through a third party to get access to DoubleClick unless you had that amount of views. Unless you had millions and millions of page views a month, you'd have to go through a third party and pay them maybe $1,500 a month, or guarantee them $1,500 a month, just to get to play with the technology. I don't know what's going
to
happen.
So there are some barriers to entry, unlike with Google Text Ads. Yeah,
absolutely.
Tangentially, Felicia, this makes me curious. Do you advertise the Guild anywhere? I mean, because you're a destination show and site, but I wonder, what do you do, if anything, to kind of, besides your social media efforts, to push out the show? Do you do any traditional advertising, or traditional online advertising, I should say?
Oh, no. You know, when I was reading up on this, because you guys said you were going to talk about it, to be honest with you, I was a little bit like, I have no idea how this works. And every time, and I'm just being honest, like every time I've kind of put my foot into the idea of kind of cobbling together advertising money, the thing is that with scripted content, you have to have so much upfront in order to be able to even make your product that I think that's been the traditional barrier to even making scripted content on the web, is that, you know, as opposed to maybe doing just a talking head show or, you know, something that's a little bit more unscripted, just the planning process and the coordination, be able to do scripted stuff is a lot higher. And that's why every time I ever explored any kind of ad network or trying to sort of like incrementalize funding, it's like, well, I can't do this because I have to pay to get it done in the first place. So as far as like, advertising our show, we don't have the money to like go out and be like, oh, I'm going to do a Facebook campaign, or I'm going to, you know, buy ad space, because I don't know what the returns would be on such a small, you know, like, I guess, I don't know. Our show does have millions of hits, you know, versus network stuff. And I guess they probably advertise a lot more than us. I mean, our show is completely funded, you know, it's completely driven by viewers and word of mouth and my social networking stuff. And, I don't know. I kind of like it that way.
And, you know, it's just, it's when you look at sort of the cost, the cost model here in terms of, you know, what you're spending and what you're getting back, it's probably quite enviable. Networks would probably be enviable to get the return on investment that you're getting. Another story that just came up today, Tim, I know you're very good on net neutrality, so I'm going to throw most of this to you to get started. But the FCC chairman, this story just came out this morning, September 21st, is proposing some net neutrality rules. And a story in Engadget says there are two big new rules which say broadband providers of any kind can't discriminate against content or applications and must be transparent about their network management policies, a big change for wireless carriers like Verizon and AT&T, who would have to open their networks to scrutiny, and a direct response to Comcast's secretive packet filtering techniques. As our net neutrality correspondent host, is this a big deal? Is this a big demarcation point in the net neutrality debate, or just sort of more of the same?
I think it's an attempt to formalize it. I mean, I think that's one of the big things right now, is that so far it's been, you know, it's the wild, wild west. We don't know what we're saying, oh, we should have net neutrality, but there hasn't been a lot that has been codified. You know,
it's
that,
just
that
been,
has
been talked about.
Yeah, we talk about it, and we say that if this keeps on going, and the thing is I know as a Comcast user, I know that if I'm going to upload to an FTP site, I know just an FTP, not BitTorrent. If I just use it for work and I'm going to upload to an FTP site, I know that I'm going to get hit. So I'll get a really, really fast connection at the beginning, and then it'll slow down really quickly. You know, and I just assume I'm getting packet shaped. You know, on the way through, it's deciding, well, they're not doing what the average user should be doing, so we're going to clamp them down. Now, what I will say is that my packet, you know, shaped version is still, you know, 1.6 megabits a second. So it's not, you know, or one almost 2 megabits a second instead of the 30 that I get most of the time. Mm-hmm. And so I'm not, you know, I find that, but it is something that opens up the window to a lot of abuse if we get into this, where it's not just, this isn't just a matter of, do I get a faster connection? Net neutrality is not a matter of, am I going to get a 10 megabit pipe versus a 15 megabit pipe or a 30 megabit pipe. Of course, you're paying differently. Someone asked me this. I was talking to them at the airport, and they said, well, what's the difference? I mean, you know, you paid a different amount to get a different speed to your house. That's not what we're talking about. We're talking about, when we're talking about net neutrality, we're saying that we should treat all the data the same, neutrally.
And what are you saying, Alex, that we should or shouldn't? Because you're saying it's open up to abuse.
It's not happening right now. We're not treating it. Net neutrality doesn't exist right now.
Right.
What's happening right now is that we decide if you're using a BitTorrent. You see, what happens is you're using different ports. You're using different kind. You know, where all this stuff is going, you can semi-identify. If you're doing FTP, for instance, you're using port 21 or 22. If you're using, and there's a bunch of this different, so you can identify where a lot of it is. Now, a lot of things will try to hide that. You know, there'll be things that try to hide this whole process to get around all of these things, because people are clamping down on stuff that they consider something that's using up a lot of their non-retail. You know, it's not a retail use of what they're doing. And so what happens is that we need to, you know, the net neutrality is really around, and it really affects us as media developers, because media is one of those things that people want to clamp down on. You know, it's a lot of data that's moving around over their networks. And so what the FCC is more formally doing is saying, you know, maybe we should start putting some code in. And of course, this is not going to go over well with AT&T, Verizon, and Comcast. You know, this is how they're trying to massage all of this stuff. I don't know if Tim has more to add.
Yeah, Tim, will we actually achieve net neutrality?
Well, you know, this is pretty big news, but I think there might be something bigger. DZ, are you using a Mac computer? Did you get a Mac? This is huge.
Oh, come on. I was going to wait till the end. Wait, can I just encode this up?
The other way. Turn it the other way.
The other way.
Oh, no. You're in the wide shot. You're in the wide shot. There it is.
There you go.
Oh, wait.
Whoa,
yeah.
Look. Yes, I switched. I converted. But you knew that.
Okay, now back to our
photo that day.
Back to net.
So this is just some proposed rules. I think the vote actually comes up in February. So we need to get the word out there and talk to people. But as a proposed set of rules, it's kind of a big blow to these people like Verizon and AT&T, these cable companies and the telcos. It's a big deal that they're not allowed to do what they want to do with their infrastructure. You know, there's a side of me, I can see both sides of the fence. Part of me wants the marketplace to decide But as an independent producer, I don't want to be shut out. I mean, could you imagine if Alicia was cut off and we couldn't see the Guild because of these types of issues, where it's like, oh, she's not paying enough to AT&T, so their customers are not going to serve her show, or she's sponsored by Sprint, so AT&T is not going to show her show.
Okay, could that actually happen, though? I mean, I understand that that's kind of a...
Well, it's more of a, will it happen? The problem is right now they don't tell you what's going on. So they make these adjustments. They do all of this stuff. And one of the things that the FCC chairman is talking about is that they have to tell you everything that's going on here. You know, they have to tell you what they're... Because what happens is you may just decide that a site is really slow. You know, if they do this, like if the site is, you might decide, oh, every time I go to that site, it's so slow and the videos play and they're all choppy and everything else. You don't realize that it's your cable provider who's clamping down.
But it's not the site.
You know,
right.
It's not the site. It's them. I mean, this is not where it is right now, but this is where it could go. So you would stop using that without knowing. Now, if A, the site, theoretically, they couldn't do that, or B, they have to tell you. We clamp down on this kind of content. You know, that's, and then as a consumer, you can choose. As long as these folks have to tell you what they're doing clearly, up front, not in the fine print, then you can make a decision. You can go, you know what, I'm not going to use Comcast. I'm going to use Sonic.net, or I'm going to use Speakeasy, or I'm going to use something else because these guys do this. Or, you know, I'm not going to use that kind of content, and Comcast is great. You know, it's really, really fast and it's cheap. But the problem is, as a consumer right now, we can't choose. It's like no labels on our, it's like, you know, kind of buying food mm-hmm. with no labels.
And
you don't know what's in it. You don't know.
It's just chaos, Alex.
It's chaos. It's chaos. It's like going to.
There's a lot of people that will argue that, well, this would never happen. Big companies would never do this. The marketplace will decide for itself. Hey, that's great. If you look at television, if you look at television shows back in the 70s and the 80s, there was a much larger percent of TV shows produced by independent producers back then than there are now. Sure. I think it's something like 80% of all media right now comes from six companies. There's been that much, buy up.
There's been so much consolidation in the last 10 years. I mean, since the FinCEN rules, right? I think in the mid-90s. Now we basically have six studios that produce the majority of the content on TV. But speaking of those studios, a really interesting ruling last week. Veo, of course, is a site that has been involved in, I think, a number of lawsuits. I think Veo had a few months back sort of a pioneering lawsuit about porn on Veo. But anyway, so here's this latest one. A federal district court ruled that Veo is not liable for the copyright violations committed by its users. Now, this is actually, so essentially if a user is uploading something from Viacom or whatever it is that, you know, that they don't own the rights to, which it's crazy to think people would do that, but it does actually happen, the site is not liable for the actions of its users, which actually, I think that what's important to look at with this case is how it may be used by YouTube. This is brought up in a CNET article, how it may be used by YouTube to defend itself against Viacom's $1 billion lawsuit, which we haven't heard about in a while. Felicia, I'm going to toss this to you as a content creator, as a video gal. What are your thoughts? I mean, not even necessarily for you specifically, but just on sort of what does this mean for copyright? What does this mean for studios? And sort of how do you look at this in terms of, you know, various rulings that there have been about online video and, you know, DMCA and all of that stuff?
I mean, I've been dealing with this a lot lately because I release my show on kind of a closed system, Xbox, and then, you know, MSN is open. That was kind of part of the reason we did our deal, so it wouldn't be completely closed off on Xbox so everybody could enjoy it. But I think you have to, I mean, I always think about consumer behavior, and there's nothing more infuriating than when I released my music video and people kept uploading it to YouTube. Now YouTube has, and I learned, you know, in the process that it has a fantastic way for somebody who has copyright to be able to just go through and remove it. It's like come leaps and bounds in the last 2 years since I've been starting content. So, I mean, for me, yeah, I mean, I don't think it necessarily has to end up that YouTube or Veo are responsible for the consumer behavior. As long as you provide really easy tools for those copyright holders to be able to pull down the video, which YouTube is very simple. At the same time, like, you're never going to be able to stop people from uploading stuff. Like, I've had many extensive conversations with like a 13-year-old on YouTube, and I'll put the time in and I'll send them a personal email like, hey, dude, this is the way I pay my electricity bill. Okay. You're taking this and you're putting it on YouTube. And like, some of them totally get it. And I send them a signed picture or they start arguing with me. It's like, well, you already leaked it on Xbox. I'm like, dude, no. Okay. I don't do this. You know, I do some of this in my shed, but like, I have to pay a lot of people to make this video, but they don't understand because I think we've gotten to the point where there's so much media and there's so much choice, for consumers that it doesn't, you know, people don't associate it with, you know, the work that goes into putting into it. You know, there's kind of a disassociation.
Right.
And it's like, well, you know, something that's, you know, somebody made with their mom outside is kind of on the same footing as a huge, you know, studio movie. So I don't know what the solution is. I just think that, you know, having, you know, tools to be able to take down videos that are copyright violation is like, what more can they do?
Now, I have a question, Felicia, actually, for you. Why don't you put your content on YouTube?
That was part of the reason, the way that I get my show funded.
Right. So, no, people were asking on our online forum. I just thought I'd bring it up.
Because your show used to be on YouTube. So is it no longer available on YouTube then?
Right.
So the first season was only on YouTube and we funded it through PayPal, but I wasn't able to pay anybody. That was just to pay for camera rental. And we paid everybody back for the first season on DVD sales, which I packaged in my kitchen. So for season two and season three, we looked for a sponsor. And we had networks and very fancy producers and lots of really cool people offered to join up with us to make the show. But I wanted to retain the intellectual property to my show. And that is a very not common thing for scripted in or anything in Hollywood. So I turned down so many deals. And the cool thing about my Xbox and Microsoft deal is that they were willing to let me retain those the intellectual property rights and the creative control of the show. And the trade-off is that they rightly, you know, justifiably in my mind, they get Sprint on board as a sponsor. They pay for the funding of my show up front, and it's a big production. And they have the whole season for, you know, exclusivity period. So, I mean, it's. I personally think it's the best, you know, solution for an independent contractor. I mean, I feel so lucky. The thing is that people don't understand that. And for YouTube, you know, we're uploading season two right now to YouTube. I don't have to do that. I'm probably losing money doing it because we do have a DVD coming out. But for me, you know, that's a way to reach audience. And in a sense, if you were talking about advertising, that's part of my advertising. Is I know there's some people who are never going to watch it on other portals, and they're probably never going to pay for it. But hey, you know, they're fans of the show; they might link it to people, and they're working as my advertisement in a sense.
What is that? You mentioned that you will go and tag content on YouTube, and you said something about a music video. When you're, because I think a lot of people are interested in sort of how copyright works and what you as a copyright owner can do. So, what is it that you're tagging? I know that you're writing to people if they're posting it before you're posting it, but did you say you're tagging music videos as well?
Well, no, I have a music video called Do You Want to Date My Avatar that we Xbox, you know, financed, and we did it as a promotion for season three. And we actually got in the top 10. We were number one music video downloaded on iTunes for like a week, and then number one MP3 on Amazon, and, you know, millions of views. It's over 4 million views right now. So it's kind of crazy and completely done, you know, just virally on our own. So, and that was released on Xbox for 2 weeks exclusive, and people kept ripping it and putting it on YouTube. But if you're a YouTube producer partner, they have a system where you can go in and literally you just search the name of your video and you can click on things that are violating your copyright. And then it gets sent to the producer program to do a review about who owns the copyright. But it immediately comes down. So, and that was not available like 2 years ago when I was first doing the show. So I think it's a huge improvement. And like, you know, it's something that everybody should have. That's because obviously they're not going to be policing it because it's just millions and millions of videos every day. So it ends up being my job.
What do we think? What does this VO lawsuit mean for Viacom and the YouTube copyright suit?
Tim?
Alex, Tim, why don't you weigh in? Putting you on the spot.
You know, it's interesting to me, the whole thing. I mean, if you look at the telephone company and you go, okay, criminal activity happens on the telephone all the time, but is the telephone company responsible for that criminal activity? No. Right. And that's kind of what's going on here with Veo, right? I mean, they're essentially a utility to upload videos to, and it's a service. And if somebody is using their service to do illegal activities, if they know about it, they should notify the authorities, and they should be held responsible for it, unless they are actively allowing people to do it and encouraging people to do it so that it helps them build their brand, then that's another issue.
And I think that it becomes, I think the model for YouTube becomes much more stable as they've really moved away from copywritten material as the core of their business. It's obvious now. I mean, it wasn't at the beginning, and maybe Viacom can argue that they wouldn't be where they are now if they hadn't used that to get off the ground. But
you know, that is an interesting point that you bring up, because if you take a look at Rever versus YouTube, Rever had a stronger place in a stronger position in the marketplace in the early days, and they chose to not allow any copyrighted material on Rever, whereas YouTube was like, you know what, business decision, we'll let it go up there and we'll police it as we can, but we can't screen all the videos. And they got billions of dollars. Rever sold for $500,000.
Right. Well, and
so apparently doing it illegally can be beneficial.
Well,
it would be
incredibly chilling if you it would be a chilling effect on the whole industry if you worried about, if you are trying to provide a service. And I mean, part of it is that it really slows things down if you have to sit there and go through and check everything, because it would be impossible to get into a situation where a provider would have to go through and make sure every image, every likeness, this is a slippery slope that just is not doable. It has to be the other way
around. Sounds like network television to me.
Yeah. No. But when you're the big difference is that is producers doing that. You know, that's our job. Like, I have tons of releases when I go to Brazil. So anybody I shoot, any logo that's in the background, and any blah, 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 you know, there's like all these releases that I have to have everybody sign in triplicate. You know, to be able to use anything that we're shooting. And so that's. But we know that that's the way it is. But when you're talking about user content, you just can't expect that individuals doing that. You can try to educate them, but still 80% of them are just going to, you know, when you're creating a service where anybody can just throw something up there. I think that especially given the way the tools have progressed in YouTube, I think that it's totally reasonable, you know, to say that, you know, people can put stuff up. And if someone has a problem with it, they can take it down. And a lot of stuff gets taken down really quickly. I think that especially when something's a hot item, you might see it on YouTube for...
Right. The onus is on the rights holder. I mean, that's what it comes down to. Alex, you posted a story this morning about ASCAP wanting money from 30-second samples on iTunes. What does ASCAP even stand for? It doesn't even know what it stands for, but it's basically the licensing group for the music business. What is
ASCAP
this all about?
ASCAP and BMI. So ASCAP and BMI. So there are, you know, rights are managed by lots of different people. And one of the things that ASCAP and BMI manage is play, basically performance rights. So when you hear something on the radio, that's a performance of that song. And ASCAP and BMI manage the uses. And it's crazy because you have the record, the RIA or the record companies, they manage the copyright and they manage some of the recording stuff. And then you have ASCAP and BMI managing performances. So if you play it at a bar, you have to pay them a royalty. You have the Harry Fox agency that plays recording the mechanical rights. So if you play a Beatles song or someone else's, then you have to get, technically you're supposed to get rights from the Harry Fox agency. So you have all these different, you know, the different people handling different rights. And so ASCAP and BMI are getting left out of this whole game because radio is going down. The problem that they have is that people are listening to 30-second pieces on iTunes. And so when you go to iTunes and you want to preview a song before you play it, before you buy it.
Oh my gosh, did they want to get paid for that? Because there isn't enough listenership anymore on radio
in the land of WTF. That's all I'm saying. You know, you read it and you go, no, they're really not asking. Now, they're also including, I mean, they, you know, these guys, the people who are already paying, you know, recommendation-based systems, so Last.fm, Pandora, you know, are paying those things. But the idea is that you want to just listen to a song to decide whether you're going to buy it. And they're saying that's a performance and we should get paid for that. You know, and so, you know, that's a 30-second performance and we should get paid for that. And I understand how a lawyer who never gets out and is kind of pasty white and doesn't really listen to anything and doesn't actually know what the internet is might make sense going, oh, people are listening to this on their computer and they're downloading it. Well, we should make them pay for that. And it just this is the problem.
Who would pay theoretically? Even though this
it'd be iTunes. It'd be
okay.
So what they're looking for is there's a big market. I mean, Apple now is the largest record market in the world. I mean, it's the largest record store or at least in the United States. I think it's in the world. Well, if it's in the United States, in the world. So it's bigger than Walmart. You know, so this is where people buy
stuff. But it's a buying venue. It's not a listening venue. It's
exactly.
So that's the difference. They're losing out because it is a buying venue.
I think they're stretching it just a little bit.
It reminds me of, we talked about a few weeks ago with the SEC, the Southeastern Conference, wanting to ban people from Twittering or Facebooking during games. And when they couldn't do that, wanting to ban people from taking photos and posting them on
Facebook.
Well,
the NFL has all
video.
These rules. We were talking about that last week. The NFL has all these rules. Of course, it makes me want to watch Steeler games and just Twitter the whole way through, you know. And now they've got the ball. You know, it's a crazy. And a lot of them are trying to head off what they think is going to be a big industry. I mean, you know, I think that's the issue is that they. But this is. This some of that stuff I kind of, as I thought about it, I can understand why they're trying to control that, but because I went up to some
they're
official
just like
site
trying to squeeze as much money from a
shifting
medium as possible.
I had to work yesterday, and we had a deadline for today, and so I was working on some visual effects shots, and I just had the Steeler thing playing in the background so I could, you know, watch my Steelers lose. Anyway, so sorry, I got a little sad. Anyway, so the but I went to the official site because that's the easiest place to find it. But I think it's their job to make it really easy and fun for me to go to that site.
I'm sorry, who? The Steelers?
It was NFL. It was like Sports Illustrated has this great little whatever that updates every couple seconds.
And oh, that's
people
what you're
blogging
okay.
about it, and it's a great way to do it. And so that was. But it was just easier. It was easier. I just went to CNN, went down to sports, and then I kind of found my way over to where I didn't know where to go. But that's fine. I mean, that's what they're trying to protect is that everyone will go there to hear play by play. Because you could theoretically have some guy doing the play by play over Twitter. And people like me would probably subscribe. You know, like, oh, I can just see what the score is on Twitter. And that's what they're trying to do. But this is just insanity. I mean, it's kind of like, and one of the things that I'm sure that somebody here figured out is it would be really easy for them to track this. So this is a real, all these other ways of doing it, whether people are listening to it in the record store to decide whether they want to buy it or whether they're, you know, there's all these things that are very difficult. ASCAP and BMI spend most of their time trying to track logs and we used to have to fill out a log. There'd be like an ASCAP week. And so when I was in the radio station, we had to fill out everything we wrote in this stupid little log, and then we'd hand it to them, and then they'd send us a bill, but it was just silly, you know, and we'd make stuff up, and we'd write, you know, like
sort of like a Nielsen diary.
It's like a Nielsen diary, you know, we just like whatever, but that's how they, but for them, this is a dream come true because theoretically, Apple and Amazon know exactly how many. People listen to every little, you know, thing she does is magic by the police. They know that was listened to 43,000 times last Monday. You know, or whatever, you know, because they have all that tracking.
It would be fun if somebody got a copy of those. If this ever happened, I would just love to see those records. It'd just be kind of fascinating look into it. I want to get to a couple listener topics because we had some folks writing in last week and Twittering what they wanted to hear about. Justin Edmead wants to hear what we have to say about the open source video movement. Companies like Kaltura and others have developed open source video players where obviously, since it's open source, people can contribute new features and so on. Did they compare? And looking at this sort of, not so much from a business point of view, but really sort of should independent producers, should new media producers be considering, you know, a Kaltura, Veeple, a Delve, you know, what do they have to offer that, you know, sort of the more entrenched platform providers don't, that sort of thing. Tim, have you looked into this at all? I mean, do you have, I know you release your videos on YouTube, and I think that's your primary hub, but correct me if I'm wrong there. But what are your thoughts in terms of using open source as a video producer? I mean, what are the pros and cons?
Sure, I think it all has to do with your threshold of pain, and what you're willing to do. You know, there are a lot of great open source things out there that I use. I haven't got into using open source video yet because there's a little bit of a technical hurdle when it comes to dealing with this. So, I use YouTube, but then for my video podcast, right now I'm using blip.com TV to deliver through the iTunes store, whereas I could be using something open source to deliver, but then I still need to deal with the hosting issue. So it's easier for me to go to an established site, and I use the pro version, which I think is like just under $100 a year, and then have them host my videos, and then I serve them up at iTunes through Blip. In the past, I've used Rever, I've used MDialog, you know, just for different reasons now, I'm with Blip, and that seems to work. That's a good solution for me right now.
Now, I want to jump to Felicia, but not necessarily on the open source topic. Early on when we were first chatting with you, I said I wanted to get some of your production tips. And this is sort of an open-ended question, but we like to do it from time to time on TWIM when we have producers on the show. And of course, you're a producer and so much more. But, you know, sort of looking back over the last few years and all the different videos that you've worked on, you know, if you were speaking to a group of producers, what are some of the tips that you would want to share with them? What are kind of the pieces of advice, you know, whether it's technical, marketing, I mean, you're a whiz with social media, I mean, whatever it is that you would want to impart to others in terms of what to do and what not to do?
Oh gosh. I mean, I guess first off, I would say make sure you're really passionate about it and you're willing to work for years for no money. I mean, I still pay most of my bills with commercial acting. So, you know, that's just what it is. This is an evolving landscape, and you just make sure you really believe in it and you aren't trying to use it as a stepping stone to get somewhere else, because you don't know what's going to happen. And why work toward disappointment? Just make sure you're telling stories and you're doing a subject that you love. And if money happens or success happens from that, well, that's just, you know, a blessing because of probably your enthusiasm. So, you know, square one, don't think you're, you know, going to make millions in web video.
Is there room for another show like The Guild? I mean, your show really kind of broke out at a time when web video was breaking out. I mean, I remember meeting you at South by Southwest 2 years ago, and that was the first season of The Guild, and you were up for a number of awards, and I was one of the judges for the Greenlight Awards held at South by Southwest, and, you know, it was just so clear that it was, you know, it was a top of the line show. So, you know, I told you, I was like, oh, I voted for your show. I was so excited when I found out it won the award, and that's really when it was starting to break out. I wonder now, with, you know, sort of a solid couple of years of history in the online video business behind us, if there are still opportunities for a scripted show like that to break out, or if we've gone just too niche in this world already.
I actually don't see a lot of other shows taking advantage of niches. I mean, I'm surprised about that. I mean, first of all, you look at Dr. Horrible and what it's accomplished in the last year. And I don't see other, you know, people like Joss Whedon jumping into the format to be able to make things outside the box, because, you know, they're all being paid a lot of money to do what they're doing. You know, and it takes somebody like Joss who's willing to, you know, put a lot of money on the line and do an experiment. I mean, it disappoints me because I think that having leaders like that in the position where they have the respect of Hollywood as well as the online, you know, fandom and passion to carry a project through like that. I mean, I always talk to people and I say, you know, they're like, oh, I have a web series. I'm like, well, who's going to watch that web series? And are they going to feel passionately about it enough to link it to their friend? Because unless you have that chain, you're never going to get off the ground with web video. I mean, if you have funny white guy friends who are dressed like hipsters doing sketch comedy, I mean, you might have one hit. But to sustain that for a series, it takes a monumental effort. And if you just think about how many billboards you see for a mainstream TV show and how many interviews that those cast members do throughout the season, you have to realize that the marketing involved is as much work as making a great product that people will feel passionately about. So, like, for me, I see some shows out there, but as far, you know, I feel like a lot of the ones that are being made, especially associated with brands, are so kind of not mediocre, but mediocre. It's kind of vanilla flavored. That's the reason why it doesn't catch. I mean, the internet is like 10 million channels on your cable box. How do you find that? Well, you have to connect with the people who will be at the place and be excited about that specific content because they're not being talked to right now. So,
what do you watch? And what do you like to watch on the internet? What web shows or videos are you watching in your spare time?
I have so little spare time, and most of it is taken up by gaming. I do like to, when I watch TubeFilter.tv, I always try to sample like what new web shows they have. And especially I'm excited when I see somebody like from Dallas making a show about comic books, or, you know, some of the professionally produced shows, like, you know, there's, I forget the name of it. Tim will know, they did the novel, the CSI guy did the novel. What is the name of it?
Level 21.
Yeah, I thought that level was really 21. Interesting.
Level 26.
Yeah, 26. Yep. Whatever it is. Yeah, so, I mean, I think there's some interesting things, people experimenting a little bit. But in general, it's just like, I feel like the subject, you know, there could be, you know, more creative ways. You can't think of it like traditional content, you know, and you have to, I think, have a lot of personality-driven marketing that goes with things. Like, I know that people, you know, me personally emailing a dude who uploads a video illegally means a lot more than, like, some suit sending them an email. You know what I'm saying?
No, absolutely. Absolutely. I couldn't agree
so,
more.
So if you want to get an autographed picture of Felicia Day, illegally upload her videos and then take them down
when
she contacts you.
I did that once.
Now it's
so
over.
Sweet.
The whole deal is over.
She's going to get so many emails requesting her autograph now. Hey, we have just a couple minutes left because we have a hard stop. I want to talk very quickly about an interesting article in PC World. Facebook now has 300 million followers. Friends, users, whatever you want to call it. And PC World kind of goes through sort of different strategies for what could be next for Facebook. Okay, that's obviously a big threshold to reach. You know, what could come next? You know, evolved gaming interactivity is cited as one example. More aggressive advertising. I don't think Facebook advertising is really, you know, that meaningful yet. Pointless offshoot. Somebody this part of what's suggested in here is just some sort of bizarre offshoot of Facebook is the next thing, and just kind of other things. And another option is just that social networking will eventually, you know, plateau and fall off. I mean, MySpace is, you know, not as important as it was probably a couple years ago. I'm just kind of going to go around the horn really quickly and just ask everyone what are your thoughts on what's next for Facebook? I mean, it could just be more of the same. Alex, we'll start with you.
I think it might be more of the same. They now have Lite Facebook, lite.facebook.com, which is kind of a Twitter-like. I like it. And I have to admit that I have Twittered a little less recently because I've been more in Facebook. And you know, my daughter kind of dragged me towards it, and then I did it a lot so that I could just interact with my kids. And but you know, she said that Facebook was kind of the, you know, she uses MySpace, but Facebook is the one that we can talk
about. The adults.
About.
I remember when she was here,
that. Yeah,
we discussed
exactly.
That.
She's like, Dad, I don't really use it, but Dad does. And so, and even then, it was a lot of data, and it took me a long time to get to a point where I was kind of comfortable with it. And there is something about Facebook that for me is, you know, so I've been a long time, and I still Twitter a fair bit, and I love Twitter, and I, you know, and I still find if I'm posting in Facebook, they're all about 140 characters. You know I'm very trained to post that, but I find that I'm when I open something up when I'm burning time, like in a line or something like that, I'm more likely to go to my Facebook app on my iPhone than my Twitter app, and it's more. There are.
Do you feel there's more of a personal connection there,
so.
Or it's partially because it's maybe a closed environment, like you know exactly who's there?
I don't know. I'm trying to figure that out. You know, I because there's a lot of people that I don't know who follow me on Twitter, but there's also a lot of people I don't know who follow me on Facebook, and so, but I do find that I'm kind of there, and I think I have more conversations with people, you know, in that are just I think the way it's organized, it's easier for me to understand, and then I can post photos really easily and insert them and little movies and other people do, and I don't know what it is, but I find myself more tied up. Like I think part of the problem with Twitter I find is that if when I respond, I always have to remember, like in the back of my head, there's 13,000 people that are going to read your response.
I know.
You know, and the direct response means I have to manage it. You know, like, so I have this thing, like, I don't really like the direct response. Last time I looked at my direct response was like 2008. So I don't really do anything with direct mail, but the, because like, you know, I kind of like it being connected. The people can read it, but they don't have to get an update every single time I respond to that person. That's the thing I think is better in Facebook. Anyway, that's my two cents.
Okay, Tim, in 140 characters or less, what's the future of Facebook?
They are going to rebrand as Friendster and go huge. It's going to be gigantic.
What do you really think?
Well, I'd be interesting to see if they or somebody else takes all the goodies of Facebook and intertwines them into a web browser. I think that's the big play is, you know, how does the web browser become the social media activity device so that you can do everything that you want to do while you're surfing the internet and still stay in contact with everybody else, and it's all part of your browser.
That's kind of interesting. I like that. That's kind of a cool concept. Felicia, what are your thoughts on the future of Facebook?
You know, I use social media I'm tied to it. I literally have the umbilical cord into my monitor. So I use it in a much different way than most people. I mean, Twitter is like, for me, people are like, oh, it's so anonymous. Like, Twitter is the most personal thing. I read every single response, even though I have like over a million followers. I treat it like my own IM to the world. And I love interacting with people and meeting, you know. And Facebook to me, I mean, just to be honest with you, it feels very sanitized and enclosed. I always get a little claustrophobic when I go to Facebook. And I don't necessarily use it, you know, like other people would do. I also have, you know, way too many people on my friends list, which I accidentally did. And, you know, whatever. The fan page is great. But for me, like, it's kind of the sanitized feel. It feels like I'm at Disneyland a little bit sometimes. So I'm, you know, never going to be like one of those people who's always on Facebook.
Right.
I totally see the advantage, especially if you have families, you're keeping in touch with people on a very close circle. But, you know, I did, when I read that article, I thought it was very interesting that they suggested like upgrading the gaming aspect of Facebook, because I mean, you know, I thought that was pretty cool, like porting some of those Xbox Arcade games kind of to the Facebook experience, because those kind of casual games are so popular on Facebook, just kind of maybe upgrading that would be a cool direction to go. But
heartening. It's very heartening to hear that you read your Twitter replies, and I'm sure that's heartening news for your 1 million followers and however many of them were getting to listen to the show. I think that's wonderful. Good for you. It's just nice to know that there is still that sort of personal level of interaction. On that note, Felicia, where can people find you online?
You can go to Twitter, Felicia Day, and I have a blog, FeliciaDay.com, my website that has a lot of stuff there, and I don't update as much as I should, but I do read all the comments and interact with people.
That's like all of us.
Right, we all say that about our websites. That's true.
I know, I try, but it's just so difficult, and I really put hours of work into it. I review a lot of trashy, you know, fantasy novels there, and I really want to get it right, so...
Oh, gosh, you know, I got to tell you a funny thing. Felicia Day and I, now you're going to get tons of Goodreads requests, or who knows, maybe not. We're friends on Goodreads, and there's a book blogger who I had just friended on Goodreads last week, and she saw my friends list, and then I saw her Twitter right after. She goes, wow, I had no idea Felicia Day was on Goodreads. How cool. So there you go. Another degree of separation. Alex, where do you want people to find you online?
They can find me on the Twitters.
At Alex Lindsay.
Yeah, Alex Lindsay.
Tim.
OneTimStreet.com or OneTimStreet on Twitter.
And you can find me at daisywhitney.com, New Media Minutes there, a way to get in touch with me, so on and so forth. Thank you, fantastic hosts, co-hosts, guests. We are over and out.